The summer 2008 Olympics will take place in Beijing, China. Human rights protesters have disrupted the Olympic relay worldwide. This is local Tibetan activist Wang Kelsing.
My name is Nawang Kelsing, and I'm a Tibetan. Right now, we are protesting against the brutal Chinese occupation, and right now in Tibet, China, they are doing a crackdown, and they have killed so many peaceful protesters, and many has been taken to jail, and many Tibetans, we don't know what's happening inside. The things are very bad, and we are against whatever the Chinese government is doing at this point. For 50 years, we've been struggling through nonviolence, and Tibet's face has never been shown in the world media so far. But this Olympic is an opportunity for us, and we are using with the maximum and for the cause of Tibet and for the freedom of Tibet. I want to urge the people of the world to support our justice and freedom. We don't have any weapons or anything, but we have a truth. And China, what they are saying is what happened inside Tibet. It was started on March 10th by a feud, a Buddhist monk from Debung Monastery. And they went to the street and did a peaceful demonstration. And they did for March 10th, March 11th, March 12th, March 13th. And when they did that, the China, what they did is, for these peaceful protesters, for the peaceful monks and nuns, and they used the greatest force, what they have done in the Tiananmen Square. And on March 14th, the people's resentment, they get frustrated. It's a people, we are human being. We did the peaceful protest, and they're doing all the bad things for the Tibetan people. And on March 14, there was some kind of violence by the Tibetan people. And this they are using as a propaganda, saying that the Tibetan people are very violent. And all this violence has been instigated, has been masterminded by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And what His Holiness the Dalai Lama is saying this, okay, the world, the international media, and the international body has to be sent inside Tibet. And they can also send to Dharamsala, where His Holiness government is in. I was born in Tibet, and my families are in Tibet. And we cannot do any contact to my families. Like me, there are so many Tibetans. I urge the world to support Tibet. We need a fact-finding. The world needs to support the immediate dialogue between His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the Beijing government.
As protests continue to bring attention to China and their human rights abuses, tonight, Circle A Radio explores the human rights abuses of the Olympics. We will speak with Kanahus Paski of the Native Youth Movement about the campaign against the 2010 Winter Olympics.
The Olympics, they say that they will only host countries that don't violate human and indigenous rights, but when you look more into it, the Olympics is involved in some of the most human rights violations there has ever been. Even during World War II, when the Olympics was held there in Germany, they had Nazi swastikas side by side with the Olympic rings, and only 45 minutes away, there was a concentration camp where they were murdering Jews, and the Olympics still did not stop. They are just the same as any other massive corporation that goes into indigenous territories, destroys land, violates human rights, and we need to bring this awareness out because a lot of people are getting tricked into the fact that the Olympics is a good thing. But the Olympics is one of the biggest monsters out there.
We'll also bring you an interview with Helen Jefferson Lenski, author of three books critical of the Olympics industry and a retired professor from the University of Toronto. Stay tuned.
According to legend, the ancient Olympic Games were founded by Heracles, a son of Zeus. The first Olympic Games for which we still have written records were held in 776 BC. The ancient Olympic Games grew and continued to be played every 4 years for nearly 1,200 years. In 393 AD, the Roman Emperor Theodosius I, a Christian, abolished the Games because of their pagan influences.
Approximately 1,500 years later, a young Frenchman named Pierre de Corbetan began their revival. In the late 1880s, Corbetan was commissioned by the French government to form a universal sports association, and his vision of an amateur championship for the world's athletes began to take shape. In 1894, he invited representatives from several countries to Paris to attend an international athletic congress. Coubertin used the occasion to propose the organization of the Olympic Games, which would be an international competition modeled on the Olympic Games of ancient Greece. The proposal passed, and that same year, the International Olympic Committee, or IOC, the international governing body of the Olympic Games, was founded. The committee selected Athens, Greece, as the site for the first Olympic Games to be held in 1896. In 1900, the second modern games were overshadowed by and incorporated into the Paris Exhibition. 1,319 men from 27 countries competed in 75 events. 11 women were allowed to compete in lawn tennis and golf.
The Summer Games of 1936 were held in Berlin, where the first ever Olympic torch relay took place. The bid to host the Olympics was won before the National Socialist Party gained power in Germany. Since, however, the party now was in power, some leaders in the government saw the Olympics as an opportunity to promote their National Socialist ideology. Adolf Hitler was convinced by Joseph Goebbels to allow the games to take place in Germany. Hitler removed signs stating "Jews not welcome" and similar slogans from the main tourist attractions. Hitler desired to clean up Berlin. The German Ministry of Interior authorized the chief of Berlin police to arrest all gypsies and to keep them in a special camp. Nazi officials ordered that foreign visitors should not be subjected to the criminal structures of the anti-homosexual laws. The 1936 Olympics in Berlin, held despite a call from the Jewish community to boycott the games, actively promoted the Nazi regime. IOC members who opposed holding the games in Berlin were dropped from the organization. Witnesses reported there were more swastikas on stage at the opening ceremony than Olympic flags. By the time the games opened, a concentration camp was operating just half an hour's journey from the Olympic site. As well, the Nazi regime initiated the modern Olympic torch relay as a way of promoting fascism through Europe. By allowing only members of the Aryan race to compete for Germany, Hitler further promoted his ideological belief of racial supremacy. African-American track and field athlete Jesse Owens won 4 gold medals for the U.S.
There were mass protests in Mexico City against hosting the 1968 Summer Olympics. President Gustavo Diaz was determined to stop demonstrations, and in September he ordered the army to occupy the campus of the National Autonomous University of Mexico, the country's largest university. Student demonstrators were not deterred, however. On October 2nd, after student strikes lasting 9 weeks, 15,000 students from various universities marched through the streets of Mexico City, carrying red carnations to protest the army's occupation of the university campus. By nightfall, 5,000 students and workers had congregated outside an apartment complex in the Plaza de las Tres Culturas in Tlatelolco. Among their chants were, "No queremos Olimpiadas, queremos revolución." We don't want Olympic Games, we want revolution. The massacre began at sunset when police and military forces, equipped with armored cars and tanks, surrounded the square and began firing live rounds into the crowd, hitting not only the protesters, but also other people who were present for reasons unrelated to the demonstration. The killing continued throughout the night, with soldiers operating on a house-to-house basis in the apartment buildings adjacent to the square. On winning the podium after the 200-meter race, American Tommy Smith and Juan Carlos raised their fists in a Black Power salute. The two are immediately suspended from the games and deported from the country.
In 1972, Munich Summer Games were overshadowed when members of the Black September group kidnapped 11 Israeli athletes from the Olympic Village, killing 2 and taking the other 9 hostage. During a failed rescue attempt by German authorities, the remaining athletes and all but 3 of the kidnappers are killed.
The summer 1980 games were held in Moscow and were the first games to be held in a communist country. Due to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, President Jimmy Carter calls upon the U.S. Olympic Committee to boycott the games. 80 nations participate in the games, down from 122 nations at Munich.
In 1983, the IOC votes to allow the games to be opened up to corporate sponsorship.
In the 1984 Summer Games in Los Angeles, the Soviet Union leads a 14-country boycott in retaliation for the U.S.-led boycott of the 1980 Games. The first privately financed Olympics are a commercial success. In addition to a lucrative broadcasting deal, there are 34 official sponsors, 64 companies with supplier rights, and 65 licensees. These are the second games ever to turn a profit, $215 million, the first being in the 1932 Los Angeles Games.
In the 1996 Summer Games in Atlanta, Georgia, increased Olympic security also led to increased racial profiling of immigrants and people of color by both police and immigration authorities. During the 1984 Games in Los Angeles, police cordoned off the mostly black neighborhoods surrounding the Olympic Village and required identification from everyone entering or leaving the area. There was a similar lockdown of the black community in Atlanta during the 1996 Games. A pipe bomb in Centennial Olympic Park killed one person and injured 111, but the Games went on.
The Sydney Olympics in the summer of 2000 were also used as a pretext to allow the Australian government to introduce permanent legislation that allows the military to be called out to quell domestic unrest. Steve Martin, the Labour Party's defense critic, called the Olympics the catalyst for the bill. The Olympics Arrangements Act was passed, giving the police the unfettered use of cameras and recording devices, and the power to prevent the distribution of materials, and the powers to search and detain people in both Olympic and public places.
Concerns about Beijing hosting the Summer Olympics resurfaced in March of 2008 after Chinese police violently cracked down on protests by ethnic Tibetans and Buddhist monks in Lhasa, Tibet.
My name is Helen Jefferson Lenski. I've just retired from 17 years being a professor at the University of Toronto, and I've written three books on the Olympics, critical of the Olympic industry, as I call it. The first one's called Inside the Olympic Industry. The second one was The Best Olympics Ever? About Sydney 2000. And the third one, coming out in June, is Olympic Industry Resistance, Challenging Olympic Power and Propaganda. I'd been a sports sociologist since I graduated with my PhD in 1983, and I'd written a lot about women and sport. That was my focus right up until the late 1990s. In addition, in 1998, a bit before that, I reconnected with a colleague, a friend who was part of a group in Toronto called Bread Not Circuses Coalition, and they had actively opposed Toronto's bid for the 96 Olympics. I wasn't at all involved in that, but I knew this woman, Jan Borowy, through other circles, and I connected with Jan and with the Bread Not Circuses Coalition in 1998, which was a very crucial turning point for the IOC, for the International Olympic Committee, because of the the disclosure about the bribery and corruption within the voting process for host cities. So I joined Bread Not Circuses at a really critical time when a lot of stuff was happening. We got loads of media attention here. We formed coalitions with groups in other countries or other cities in Canada and the U.S. And we were very active for a number of years, right up until 2001, when Toronto was bidding for the 2008 Games, which went to Beijing. While we were relieved that Toronto didn't get it, our position was that no city should have to host the Olympics.
What is involved in the protocol to become a host city? How does a city get chosen to become a host for the Olympics?
What the public, the taxpayer, the voter sees in the bid process is really the tip of the iceberg, because in every city that I've studied, I know there's been a kind of underground movement of the big wheelers and dealers, the politicians, the big business people, mostly men, the developers, real estate industry, hospitality industry. They're all kind of getting together and saying, let's organize a bid. And then they go public and take up a big advertising campaign to get public support. They quite actively suppress voices that are opposed or critical to the bid. They have a huge budget, huge advertising public relations budget to get public support. And they spend millions of dollars just to prepare a bid. And then the IOC creates a short list based on all the bid cities' applications, and then the IOC sends an inspection team to the shortlisted cities, and they put on a big party, and there's a standard way where they get children, particularly ethnic minority children, to sing and dance. They get native people to sing and dance. It's all part of this window dressing to impress the IOC inspection team and to say that they're going to be inclusive and socially responsible and all those nice things, which, as I said, is window dressing. I haven't seen any Olympics that have lived up to their promises such as they are. The IOC does not include words like social responsibility in its guidelines. It does include environmentalism. That's, in fact, the third pillar of the Olympic movement. There's sport and there's culture and then there's the environment or environmentalism. They don't mention social responsibility, and in fact, when a colleague from Bread Not Circuses and I attended a Toronto bid committee meeting and spoke to Richard Pound, who is the one of the Canadian IOC representatives, and said, why not put social responsibility in? And he said, after he told us that we were at the bottom of the food chain, unquote, and this is what we might do to sort of get our voices heard, he said it would be seen as interfering with domestic policy if the IOC said that a bid, or the country represented by the bid, had to be socially responsible and democratic or anything along those lines, anything to do with politics. The irony is that with the current Beijing Olympics, the popular wisdom, all the kind of selling points for giving it to Beijing was that this would drag China kicking and screaming into the 21st century. They didn't say kicking and screaming, but that was the sort of idea, that there'd be pressure on China to clean up its act in terms of human rights violations. And I knew from the outset that that was pure rhetoric, and that the alleged pressure that hosting the Olympics has on a bid city or bid country is totally mythology. I would say the adult athletes have a responsibility. They choose to train for this event knowing it's tarnished history, knowing it is political. They can't just kind of present themselves as pure and innocent simply because they're athletes and they're not committee members or sort of higher up the hierarchy. What the Olympic industry boosters like to do is to hark back to the poor, innocent athletes. Rog, who the president, Rog, is typical of that kind of voice that says, don't have a boycott, don't interfere with the torch relay, stop protesting. You're hurting innocent athletes. The top officials in the Olympic industry point to the innocent athletes and as if any politicizing will hurt them, and that protesters are therefore evil human beings because they're hurting innocent bystanders, in a sense.
So once the host city gets picked, then what happens once they've been granted host city status?
There's an American researcher who referred to the process in Atlanta for 1996 as the Imagineering. So it's sort of image building and engineering combined. That captures what every host city tries to do, and they tend to start with what are, in fact, the most vulnerable populations, homeless people. Street sweeps, which is one way of putting it, enacting legislation to pretty much criminalize homelessness, prostitution, and panhandling so that the usual survival behaviors of homeless people, street homeless people, are criminalized, and they can conceivably and have been arrested and charged with breaking laws when they are doing these everyday things that they tend to do, like panhandling or, in Atlanta, getting food out of garbage bins outside restaurants. Even that was criminalized. Lying on a park bench was criminalized. So all of this is in the interest of presenting a squeaky clean image to the world, or more importantly, presenting an image that looks as if this is an economically prosperous city, because it's all about money, it's all about profit making. So the fact that the vulnerable homeless people are suffering is a minor concern for Olympic organizers and Olympic industry officials. Getting this very polished, world-class city image is what they're attempting to do. So that's one aspect of it, the legislation to just get people off the streets and make the problem invisible, at least for the duration of the Olympics. There's all the rhetoric about the eyes of the world being on the city, and that's meant to sort of somehow shame local politicians or pressure local politicians into cleaning up the city in terms of what they see as ugly sights, that is, people sitting on the sidewalk begging for money or food. And that's not seen as ugly because it's such an ugly commentary on society. It's seen as ugly because businessmen and developers and so on are going, and tourists are going to visit the city. They want them to spend money. They want them to think about putting an office in, a branch office in the city. They want the multinationals to see the city as a good environment and so on.
Continuing with Atlanta as an example, now that the Olympics were there a little over a decade ago, can you talk about the lasting impacts of surface beautification and then the effect that it's had on the people and continues to have on communities there?
Yes, a lot of the legislation stayed in place. It wasn't just for the duration of the Olympics, so it made life for homeless people considerably more difficult, criminalizing those kinds of behaviors that are routine survival behaviors, police harassment by private security forces that are hired by local business people in downtown Atlanta. And the university has owned a park that was a public park, but it's basically been privatized, and the coffee food vans that were driving around distributing food to homeless people have been banned from that park and from the vicinity of that park, been given parking tickets and bizarre sort of persecution, not just of homeless people, but persecution of people who are trying to help them and feed them.
I read parts of the best Olympics ever, and you were talking about how in Sydney they were using Aboriginal culture to sell the Olympics. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
In addition to the usual things, and that was getting the kind of token Aboriginal people to join the group that went to wherever the IOC was meeting to sort of demonstrate that there was Aboriginal support for the bid, then they had the usual sort of children singing and dancing. There was a lot of interest in getting what they called aboriginality into the logos and the trademarks and everything. So they had a kind of boomerang design in bright colors with a little section of it that resembled the dot painting of the desert Aboriginal groups from Western Australia who do a traditional dot painting, style of painting. So they dropped a few dots into it, and then it became sort of inclusive and had enough aboriginality to satisfy the white guys who were running the show.
In Sydney, I also understand that as well as criminalizing poor people, that protesting was criminalized. What kind of specific measures were put in place to try to stop resistance there?
Well, the IOC already bans protest in or near Olympic venues, but the way Sydney organized its Olympic venues, and it also organized some other areas where they had jumbo screens like they do in big sports grounds, ballparks and so on in North America, these huge TV screens with live streaming of events from the main venues, and they were out of bounds for protesting as well. So I looked at a map of Sydney and the region around Sydney and drew the circle that was the no protest zone around each of the live sites as well as each of the stadiums and use. And pretty much the whole of Sydney was obliterated in terms of protest being banned by this legislation. some of the legislation, the Sydney Harbour Foreshore Act, ban protests in areas that have for decades been traditional sort of protest or public speaking, public assembly areas. The legislation didn't stop, as with other cities. It didn't have an expiry date when the Olympics left town. Some had no sunset clause. Some went on for another 4 years. Some is still in place. So the draconian laws around behavior in sports grounds and public places around the harbor has clamped down on protest. Not that it's, it doesn't mean that people in Sydney are not protesting about a variety of things, but there certainly was a chilly climate for protest and remains that. I think the huge budget that the Olympic industry has for advertising amounts to indoctrination in a lot of ways. And the last half of my new book, or sort of the biggest half, in fact, is about Olympic education, so-called, and celebrity sports figures as so-called role models. The Olympic public relations machinery get a huge amount of mileage out of pushing this role model idea to children and adolescents. And teachers often get co-opted into being part of this to circulate all this Olympic material. It's very often free. The reference in my subtitle to Olympic propaganda is a reference to this indoctrination that goes by the name of Olympic education, and I think parents and teachers should watch out for that. Every country, if you look, search on Google for Olympic education in US and Canada and Australia, New Zealand, UK, everybody has it. It's a big industry, and it's this uncritical view of Olympic history. The, you know, boycotts are painted in a negative way, protests are depicted in a negative way. It's all this idealistic kind of language about the Olympics and how magic they are and life-changing for athletes and so on and so on. And the sort of scenario where the Olympic athlete comes into the classroom or goes to the auditorium and shows her medals or his medals to a whole lot of children who are sitting there swept away by the magic, that's dangerous stuff.
What would you like to see happen around the Olympics?
Well, in the conclusion of my first Olympic book, Inside the Olympic Industry, I called for dismantling of the Olympic industry. And that's still my position. I said in that book that people who enjoy sport and value social justice should boycott the Olympics completely and be involved if they're high-performance athletes, and I'm not at all suggesting dismantling high-performance sport, but athletes and other people involved with high-performance sport could turn their energy and attention to and participate in a lot of other international sporting competition that doesn't have the horrendous history of the Olympics. So for Commonwealth countries, there's the Commonwealth Games. There's world championships in every major sporting discipline. There's Gay Games, which are one of the most inclusive events on the planet in terms of participation. So there are many other options. Even though in bad times it really does seem the Olympics are the only game in town because they dominate so much of the economy, the politics, human rights, environment, and so on. But there are other alternatives. It could, in theory, disrupt the Olympic industry in a very dramatic way if athletes and coaches and trainers and everybody in high-performance sport directed their energies to some of the other international sporting competitions. A group in Geneva, a non-government organization called the Committee on Housing Rights and Evictions, released a study last June that I mention in my new book, and they documented or an estimated 2 million people being displaced from the Summer Olympic host cities since the late 1980s, and in Beijing, 1.25 million already displaced as of last June, and they predicted another 250,000, and then 400,000 migrants with temporary housing, and they were going to be homeless or displaced. And I think the estimates of this Geneva organization didn't even take into account some of the other displacement in China with the dams and the water problem in Beijing and the amount of water that's going to be diverted to Beijing for the Olympic visitors throughout 2008, and the impacts in terms of farmers in the sort of hinterland of Beijing. So these numbers are huge, the numbers of displaced people who are displaced by the Olympics. The mayor of Vancouver has taken total law and order approach to cleaning up the streets. He produced a report called The Civil City, where it was sort of a replica of the Atlanta situation with homeless people criminalized, demonized, and so on. And in addition to that, there's a colleague of mine, Conrad Schmidt, who's produced a film called Five Ring Circus in collaboration with Chris Shaw. And Chris Shaw has written a book which is coming out in a couple of months called Five Ring Circus, which is the sort of inside scoop on Vancouver's bid and the story behind the stories. And Chris Shaw has uncovered some very damning evidence to do with the misplaced priorities and broken promises. There are a lot of community groups in sort of loose coalitions, and they have a range of positions from sort of more liberal, or some of them started off more liberal, thinking that they could perhaps send a representative to the bid committee or the organizing committee, or work on in an advisory capacity with the organizing committee. And at the other end of the spectrum, the more radical groups that are calling for boycotts. The liberal, some people who did actually try to work more closely with the organizing committee pretty soon were disenchanted because they weren't being listened to, and some of them jumped ship, which was a wise thing to do because they were really wasting their time and energy.
That was Helen Jefferson Linsky, author and retired professor. You are listening to Circle A Radio at KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Tonight, we are talking about human rights abuses of Olympics, past and future.
Waik, my name is Kanahus Beshki. I'm from the Suquamish Native Youth Movement in so-called British Columbia, Canada, from the Suquamish Nation. Our ancestors have occupied our nation since the beginning of time. We have been here since when the mammoths have walked the earth. Our ancestors have passed down all of this knowledge for us to continue to protect and preserve this land. When the settlers first came here, that was in my great-great grandmother's grandfather's time period, and so it's really short in colonization history that our place has been occupied and invaded by settlers and corporations. The 2010 Winter Olympics will be taking place majority on the Tsleil-Waututh territory and the Squamish territories, the Tsleil-Waututh territories and their Coast Salish peoples, but the effects are being felt all the way up to the north, all the way to the interior, all around into the Rockies and everything. The whole part of BC is being affected by the 2010 Winter Olympics being held in our land. And the government is seeing it as a prime time for them to market our lands and market the rich resources that are on our lands, including mining, water extractions, the deep sea port up at Prince Rupert, which they want to make the biggest deep sea port on the West Coast that will be bringing on all the goods from China and Russia and things like this. So they're really looking at
everything, every type of natural resource that is here on our land, to find ways that they could draw in investors. And it's a big, huge commercial. There's going to be millions of people watching the Olympics, and it's a big commercial to market our land, and it's a land grab. It's a land grab that we have never seen since first contact. And a lot of our land here in this territory, I say our land, like, as indigenous people, this whole province of British Columbia, is so vast. There's untouched valleys. There's pure glacier creeks and streams. And there's vast amounts of wildlife that still live in these mountains. There's sockeye salmon and trout and sturgeon. There's grizzly bears and mountain goats and every type of animal that you could think of. They're still in the wild, still in the backcountry, in the bush. And this is what we need to protect. We need people to know that we don't want to open this province up for business. We don't want that. People may think, oh, well, I'm just going to go up as a tourist to British Columbia, and I'm going to go to the islands. It's so beautiful, or the mountains. I'm not going to leave garbage and everything. But they're contributing to the economy, and they're building up the army and the military and the government that is fighting against us. When you think about Native people, when they're fighting to protect their land so we can be free. And when you talk about freedom, we have to think, what does freedom mean? What does freedom mean to you? And what does freedom mean to me and to Indigenous people? My great-grandfather was able to walk the land free, really free. And the only thing that he had to abide by was the spiritual laws, the natural laws that have been set in place since the beginning of time through creation, through our Indigenous, like, sovereign government structures, which was always for the people and the land first. So he was able to walk the land, and he was able to hunt, and he was able to cut down trees and build himself a kukuli, one of our traditional homes. And he was able to fish when it was the right time for the people to fish and pick berries. And all of this was a natural cycle, a natural law. But now our people cannot do that, and this is what we are fighting for. So for our children, we'll once be able to know that sense of freedom. We have to create that type of vision for people to see. When you say freedom, it's not like a Canadian citizen when they're living on our land and they're saying, oh, we come from a free country. It's something different, but we could all aspire for that freedom. It's the true sense of freedom that none of us have ever been able to feel. But we can accomplish that as people, like humans on this planet, because they say that the world is not going to be able to sustain this way of living, the colonizers' way of living. And with the 2010 Winter Olympics coming to this area, it's really uniting a lot of Native people that have just been working within their own territorial boundaries, like the Sihuatmuk people working with the Stasiam people and the Tsimshian people, and like all the different Native nations of BC coming together and saying, okay, well, we need to mobilize in masses against something that we have in common. And right now it's fighting against the 2010 Olympics. There's highways going through. They're blasting up grizzly bear habitat. They're blasting into untouched valleys and, you know, trying to push massive multi-million dollar ski resorts all over the province, not just near Vancouver, like all over the whole province. And it's about coming together and putting our heads together. And not one person has the answer, but we could all work together to resist all of this bombardment of everything that's coming towards us. Right now, what the Olympics is doing is they're offering a lot of Native people money. And they're saying that this Olympics has the most Indigenous involvement than any other Olympics in all of Olympic history. But they are lying. The masses of the people here are against the Olympics and what it represents. All they are speaking to is the Indian Act government-imposed, like tribal governments, tribal administrators. They're the Native elite that are getting wined and dined by the government. And they are the ones in the media that's saying that, oh, we are inviting the world to our territories. But the grassroots people, the people from the communities, the hunters and the berry pickers and the people who depend on the land, they don't want the Olympics because it means that they are taking food out of their children's mouths. We depend on the land for our food. there's a drastic effect when there's any type of development in the mountains on our food, on our animals and our berries.
Can you give us an update on Sun Peaks?
Sun Peaks Ski Resort, they are now on their second phase of development. It's a $285 million expansion. They have a total of five-phase expansion that they are saying they are working on that has been approved by the province of BC. The first phase was a $75 million expansion, and that was the development of one more whole mountain and Delta Hotel, which is owned by Fairmont Hotel. So there's a boycott on both Delta and Fairmont Hotels because of their involvement in the Sun Peaks Ski Resort. And this has taken away a lot of the men's hunting grounds. It was a moose hunting grounds on Morrissey Mountain, and they have clear-cut the whole side of the mountain, half of the whole mountain for ski runs. That was the first phase. Now they're pushing for more development and infrastructure on the base of the mountains. And what they eventually want is five entire mountains, which is going farther into the backcountry area and moose hunting grounds, deer hunting grounds. And even the caribou have frequented that area in the past, but we are losing that. The herd doesn't come down to our area from the north anymore because of all of this development. What is really scary is that the encroachment that the Sun Peaks Ski Resort is doing onto more untouched areas is going into wetland areas, very sensitive wetland marshes that the animals are dependent on. They want to build condominiums all around the fresh mountain lakes in the farther back in the backcountry. And this goes into farther untouched areas, into Adams Lake area, which is a very sacred and important area to our people, too. So the more that the Sun Peaks Resort expands, it's threatening other areas in the backcountry. Sun Peaks Ski Resort is actually located in the 1942 Nisqually Douglas Reserve, which was set up by Chief Nisqually, and it was illegally reduced to what it is now. So there is a claim in place with the Canadian government that, like, we have the traditional, like, the real cloth map that was set out and the stakes that were put in the ground, and Sun Peaks is actually occupying in the reserve recognized boundaries. But we have lost hope in any hope that the government is going to respect that we have any type of title or anything to the land. We go to their courts, the judge isn't going to really look at the Canadian laws and say, okay, yeah, you do have rights, because if he does look at the Canadian laws the way they read, he'll have to evict himself out of his own home. Their laws and their international law system says that they cannot be occupying our territory. There's continuing boycott on the Sun Peaks Ski Resort and any intra-west owned resorts, Squaw Valley, and I think there's like five or six resorts in the States that are owned by intra-west. IntraWest is North America's largest resort real estate development. And that is the scary thing about there's ski resorts being built all throughout this whole province. It's not the ski resorts that are making them the money. It's the real estate, because they buy the stolen land for dirt cheap, and they block it up. They make condominiums, and they sell them, and they make it such a big, huge profit off of it. And it's really a real estate. That's how people are making money in this land. People want to buy a home in the ski resort little village. We say don't even buy land in BC, don't purchase any land at ski resort developments, and let people know that Native people really depend on the land and the mountains, and the mountains have always been the most sacred of our places, spiritually, for our food, for everything. It is one of the most sacred areas that we could have is in the mountains. Mm-hmm. That's why we have been fighting so hard against the Sun Peaks Ski Resort. Our elders have said no to the Japanese owners. Since 1994, they have been saying no to him, and his name is Masayoshi Okubo from Tokyo, Japan. And we've been saying no ever since, and we had over 75 people arrested. We've had people in jail for months, taken away from their children. I was one of the people that were arrested. My baby was only 3 months old, and they took me away for 3 months, and he was just 3 months old. They have no type of care for our people or our children. And we are women, and we are aunties, and we are grandmothers, and we are the women that are standing up for our nations. The Whistler Ski Resort, it's the same way. they have pushed people off of their trap lines, off of their hunting areas, to build the Whistler Ski Resort. And the masses of people, of the Stassian people from the community, they don't want that ski resort there, which is now turned into a municipality, which has Starbucks and, you know, any other type of corporation that would be in any municipality or town. Sun Peaks is applying for to be a municipality too right now, which we are fighting against. Developing the mountains has always faced fierce opposition by Native people. Even in the past, in 1960, when Sun Peaks was Todd Mountain, the chairlifts were burnt to the ground. The Delta Hotel, when it was first starting to be built, it was burnt down to the ground. They got it up like 3 months after it was. They were already starting to build it again. There's always been opposition to the Sun Peaks Ski Resort, and we are continuing to oppose it and find by any means to start educating. And now with the younger people, like the 13, the 14, the 15-year-olds that are organizing against the Sun Peaks Ski Resort, it's inheriting the struggle to keep on fighting against this development. And you go to Sun Peaks, and it doesn't even look like it's making money. How does it stay afloat? Well, it's the selling of the homes that is keeping it alive.
And I read on No 2010 on the website that the government had put into play a resort strategy and action plan in 2004. It's actually a neoliberal program that they're putting together with the corporations to develop all over BC and all over Canada.
Yeah, they needed to put something in place to show that the investors, that everything will be all right, that there's Natives that we are working with. And it's just really to show investors that it is safe to invest in BC. The Natives are getting dealt with and everything like that. That's why we need help from everybody around to get this word out, is that, no, their investment is not safe. Don't invest in BC, because their investment can be crushed. They could be chased out of the territory. There could be massive protests and demonstrations against them and their push for development. Colonization has affected many generations. Right now, it's the fourth generation that is being affected by colonization. And now here I am, I'm speaking in, you know, the white man's language. I'm speaking in English, and that's one of the things that have been lost through colonization, was the loss of our language and loss of culture and traditional knowledge on how to continue to live off the land. Like my grandparents and my parents' generation, my great-grandparents' generation were taking away from their families and forced into Christian and Catholic residential schools, these mission school systems that, you know, sexually abused the children. Some of the schools, up to 95% of the children were sexually abused and molested by priests and nuns, because child pedophiles flocked to those schools because it was behind closed doors and the government didn't care about the Native children. They made it law for children to go to these schools, to their language to be forced and whipped out of them. A lot of those effects, those intergenerational effects, are affecting the youth of today. But what Native Youth Movement has done is, you know, resurrected that warrior spirit, that pride in being who we are, that we are Native, and educate the young people and our communities of the history of why we are in the situation we are in. It is not because we want to be in the situation, it is because of the history of colonization that has been forced on our people. So that's one of the key things when you look at the history of Native people, is the residential school system. Another one is the reservation system, the enforcement of the Indian Act, and that is the elected government-imposed chief and council system that has been really pushed on our people, and the welfare and the social problems that comes with being confined to a concentration camp, being confined to a small, tiny little area of our vast traditional territory. Cities, they continue to grow with the population, but the reserves, they just stay the same size, and that caused a disruption in the way we live, because we are nomadic people. We lived with the land. We lived where the berries were ripe and the roots were right and the medicine was good and the moose hunting grounds were plentiful, and we traveled with the food, what was available to us for our sustenance, for our survival. And now, many of our Native people being arrested for hunting. You know, the Department of the Wildlife and Fisheries are coming into Native people's homes and going right into their deep freezes and taking all of the elk meat. taken all of their fish. My grandfather had the same problem when he was a young man, where they went and they took away the fishing traps, where they broke their spears in front of them, and they couldn't provide for their families. And that was a really a crush on the whole spirit of the man, the spirit of the man who was used to providing, the spirit of the mother that was used to providing for their children, and then the children to be taken away. And for the listeners that are going to be listening to this, they could imagine someone coming and taking their children away. And if you did something about it, you were thrown in jail. So you had two people locked up now, your babies, your children, and the parents. Continued to happen, and the laws that were set in place by the colonial government from 1927 to 1951, it was illegal for us to hire a lawyer to bring up these land issues, that our land was being illegally stolen while we were sent to these reservation systems. From 1927 to 1951, it was illegal to hire a lawyer for me to be talking to you right now. It would have been illegal for three or more people to come together to talk about and strategize how we are going to fight for our land. It was illegal for our people. So that was 1951, and that was just a short time ago. But now it hasn't really changed, because when Native people such as myself and such as other Natives that are standing and fighting for their rights, they are put in jail. So the same things are happening. There is no structure within the Canadian government to deal with Native land issues. The federal government says, you talk to the province of BC, but the BC government is just a provincial body. And then BC says, well, if you want to talk about land issues, then there's a process for you to go in, and that's the BC treaty process, which is saying that you extinguish all of your rights entitled to your vast traditional territory for a small little piece of land, and we'll give you money, and we'll phase in taxes in a couple of years, and you'll become Canadian citizens. But majority, the massive of the grassroots people are saying, no, we are not going to sign treaties. Why are we going to sign treaties with a government who is illegally occupying our land? We are not going to give the Canadian government authority over our lands and resources, because we are sovereign nations. They have never won our land by war or treaty. We've never ceded or surrendered our land in any way to the Canadian government, to Great Britain or the Queen. We will not negotiate for something that is already ours. So where do we go from there? And with the Native Youth Movement, it's about education, about educating and building the skills of our people, educate about the history of why we are where we are, the fight that our ancestors have done to get us to the place we are now, and where we are going to go from now as the young people. And a lot of it is, right now, we are always on a reactionary, oh, this mining company is proposing to take this land right here, and that's going to destroy our water. This company is trying to bottle our water up in the mountains near Adams Lake. These are all current things that we are fighting against. The condominiums, they want to build at 30 feet from the world's largest sockeye salmon spawning grounds in Adams River. And then the garbage dump that they're trying to put on our reserve for the 2010. It's like a bombardment of all of this development, or we call it destruction, on invasion onto our territory. And so we must build the skills of the young people to say, okay, well, we have never been in this situation in all of our history of Indigenous Tsleil-Waututh people. This is the first time that any of the Tsleil-Waututh lineage has ever had to put up with all of these things and come together in a sort of like a white man's structural way to say, okay, well, how are we going to fight these massive multi-billion dollar corporations as being Tsleil-Waututh people with no more than a couple pennies in our pocket, and we're fighting billions of dollars. So it's about mobilization and movement and growth, and, you know, meeting more people that are fighting, and non-Native people and Native people and Indigenous people from all around the world, and hearing what has worked for them and how we are going to all come together as all social sectors to fight against all this invasion, including the big 2010 Winter Olympics, which is just marketing our land for further development and encroachment.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because we're only about 6 hours from the border, I believe, and I saw that there is a call for disruption. On the website, it says probably we won't be able to stop the 2010 Olympics, but definitely there can be disruption. So can you talk about what the Native Youth Movement is asking of people both locally and then a little bit further away?
We were invited to a Zapatista gathering down in Mexico in mid-October of 2007, and we announced a convergence that was to take place during the Olympics from February 10th to the 15th of 2010 for a massive convergence in Vancouver to disrupt the Olympics, to come together as all sectors of society to fight against what the Olympics represents and against the corporations that fund the Olympics and the massive greed and capitalism and everything that it represents. The Olympics will come and go, but what are we going to do as people to commit to action, to commit to continuing on fighting against capitalism and greed? We are asking for people all around the world to hold actions against the Olympics as well, whichever way they can. I know the torch relay is going to be coming through, and once that is announced, it'll be posted on the website. There has been people on the East Coast that have committed when the torch comes from the east to the west that they will be disrupting the torch relay. The Mohawks from the East Coast have also said that they are in total support against the 2010 and that they will be sending out Mohawk warriors and getting the message out in their territory. All the way down in Mexico, they are fighting against 2010 too. It is 100 years of the Mexican Revolution, and it is being hijacked by the Mexican government to downplay the resistance that has taken place. What the grassroots people are doing is they say that every 100 years there is a great fight, that there is a great war. So the native people in Mexico have asked people from the world to go down and support them, and there's going to be a call out too in Jalisco. They will be coming up and supporting us. So any type of action that could be taken place against the Canadian government or against the Olympics, bringing attention is needed. And some people may think like, oh, well, I thought the Olympics was always about peace and it was really good because all the countries of the world are getting together without war and all of these things, but not understanding that they are making money on the backs of Native people. They are the ones that are losing their food. They are the ones that are losing their land for entertainment. When the Summer Olympics are over in China, they will begin to advertise the Winter Olympics internationally. So they can't advertise the 2010 Olympics nationally until the Summer Olympics are over. After the summer, people will probably be hearing more about the Olympics coming to this land, to our territories. We're trying to get as much awareness out there. I know that there's a lot of media attention on China right now over the protest against the Olympics, and we hopefully want to bring that much attention to our fight here on our land here in so-called BC.
That was Kanahush Pesky of the Native Youth Movement. For more information about the campaign against the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver, go to www.no2010.com. Helen Jefferson Lenski is the author of Inside the Olympic Industry, The Best Olympics Ever, and the forthcoming Olympic Industry Resistance. Circle A Radio can be heard every first and third Wednesday here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland, and can be reached through www.kbu.fm/CircleA Radio or email us at circleARadio@gmail.com. Our next show will air May 21st. Thanks for listening.